A radio program that looks at the UFO topic from a fresh perspective. Sound interesting? Then join us here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Friday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Central for The Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner.
The Church of Mavis with hosts Jeffrey Richard and Guy Weddle. 10 p.m. Central Saturdays. Opening the gates of the underworld and calling down beings of ancient starlight. Tune in and watch for the apocalypse on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come to our forum at MavisIncarnate.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest will be Mr. John Burroughs. In July 1979, John Burroughs was in the Air Force. A base security officer at RAF Bentwaters, 80 miles northeast of London, England. On December 26, 1980, Sergeant Burroughs' life was forever changed when he and several other base personnel had an encounter with a UFO at the perimeter of the air base. There was a recent article on the BBC website by a very misinformed journalist blasting the Rendlesham Forest incident and reports made by the witnesses to the event. John Burroughs has graciously agreed to be a guest on Eye to the Sky tonight and to give rebuttal to this journalist statement and the article on the BBC website. And John, you know, welcome, and thank you very, very much for being with us tonight.
Well, and thank you for having me.
Am I correct in assuming that you were also one of the co-founders of the Facebook page Justice for the Bentwaters 81st Security Police at Rendlesham Forest 1980?
Yes. I started with the blog, and blogs are kind of hard to keep up with, so it was suggested to me to do a Facebook site. And it's done in a way that I actually had helped creating it, but it wasn't done for me, it was done for everybody, because truthfully, just as you said just about this latest BBC report, we have not been treated fairly, and justice has not been done for us. And this site is for everybody, not just for me.
I've noticed that. I've been watching some of the postings there, you know, since it started, and especially over the last couple of days concerning this BBC article. And for those who are listening that don't know anything about this article, There is a link to it on my website at eyetothesky.net. That's E-Y-E, the number two, thesky.net. To kind of start this off, I'm not going to read the whole article. There's just a few lines here that I'd like to read that shows really how inept, I guess you could say, the writer of this article is. I'll let his own words speak for himself. This article is entitled "The Truth Is Not Out There" by Evan Davis. And I quote, "Let me be completely honest. I do not believe in aliens, UFOs. Nothing could persuade me that extraterrestrials are hovering above us or getting ready to drop down for tea. It is an issue, in fact, on which I am uncharacteristically closed-minded. There is no evidence you can cite that would make me change my mind. I would always regard it as far more likely that the evidence was planted by Earthlings trying to convince us of UFOs rather than by Martians themselves." And then he later, a little bit further down, goes into saying, "I have never felt any need to read about Britain's Roswell, completely sure as I was that an alien craft had not been seen in the skies over Sussex. But nonetheless, this week I went out into the woods to investigate." Now, John, I'm sure that this angered you just as much as it did me, if not more.
Well, my first reaction was, and I used the word the other day, was pathetic. And it didn't surprise me, but to me it was pathetic not because the guy he picked to go out there was a mean riffath, not because he did the article, but just the fact that the BBC would let him do something that one-sided. And he would take it on himself to personally attack everybody involved. That was the part that got to me the most. I mean, the fact that Ian restated what he's been saying for years on his website and everything else wasn't the big issue to me. It was just the fact that it was all one-sided and they didn't even give the courtesy to contact any of us. It didn't have to be me. It could have been any one of us that were involved with this and at least give us a chance to go on the record. He just did this one-sided. And it surprises me the most, not the fact that he did it because of what he said his beliefs are, but the BBC even allowed this.
Well, and then they went back and rehashed an explanation that has been repeatedly debunked, and that is the Orford Ness Lighthouse.
Right, no doubt. I mean, again, that's Ian Ridpath's claim to fame. He's created a website. And spent, as the author himself, even though Ian is now trying to deny that, he spent a lot of his career and time trying to attack the guys that were out there that night. And, I mean, I don't understand why the BBC would do this. I can understand why skeptics and critics do what they do, but I thought the BBC was fair and balanced, and I thought they allowed people to do both sides of the story. And it's clear in this particular case they didn't, and I don't understand. And as far as I'm concerned, they still haven't responded to why they did it this way.
Oh, well, and then there's a write-in campaign, so to speak, organized by yourself and Jim Peniston and many others to get people to write into the BBC voicing their displeasure.
Right, there is. And I just posted something. Jim and I did an interview yesterday, and we talked a little bit before, and we talked after it today. And what we've come to the conclusion is this, and I'm sure some people out there is going to say it's risky or whatever, but Ian Ridpath likes to point at Colonel Hall, myself, and others that we're looking for fame, yet he's the one that has a website that he, who was never even involved in the incident, has created himself and wants to draw attention to himself. So what we have done now is we're planning on going over to England, whether we can get some sponsors behind us and do some conferences or not, but we're willing to come over to England. We're planning on coming over the 28th to the 31st, and Jim and I are going to be out at Rendlesham on the 28th of December, and we're inviting Ian to join us with his BBC friends and have Ian have the opportunity, which he likes to do all the time on his website and run his mouth, and show the world and us how we could mistake what we saw, and he claims was a lighthouse, planets, and stars. I mean, we'd love to have him do that. We'd love that he's wanted his fame. Now he's got the opportunity. He hasn't responded to us at all. I've sent out the invitation, but we would love for him to do it. He loves to do this, so now take some people that were involved with this, come out and show us and his BBC friends that what we were seeing is what he claims to be.
In other words, he can put his skepticism where his mouth is?
Sure, why not? I mean, he loves to hit us, cheap shot us. He's really spent the last few years really going after Colonel Hall a lot. And show us. Show the world. Show the world how that lighthouse is anything close to what Jim and I encountered that night. Show the world how what was flying around up in the sky and saw on the Colonel Hall tape, how a star could be mistaken for what Colonel Hall was talking about and had a beam of light coming down to his feet. I mean, show us. Go ahead. Let's do it. We'll be there. We'll stand up to you. Some people will say it's risky because we're giving him a chance for some fame or whatever. Well, actually, his fame is that he wants to run his mouth. So come on out and show us. Prove to us in the world, back up what you're saying. Because it's been real easy for him to take shots at us and have nobody challenge what he says and then get upset when we say something. But now it's his chance to come out and show us that that's what it is.
Oh, well, then, you know, one thing that bothers me about these, I'm trying to be nice here, these skeptics, in trying to say that the Orford Nest Lighthouse was the cause of the incident. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the light of the lighthouse one color, and the objects we're seeing over the course of this incident, you know, of this multiple night incident, different colors?
Well, that is a fact, though. The lights that we've seen are different than the color of the lighthouse, yes. And these lights were moving up and down in the sky. They were moving around. They were observed by a lot of people. And one of the things that's been going on now for the past over a year, Linda Moulton Howe and I have been working on getting as many witnesses together as we can to talk about it, and there's been several new witnesses that have come forward then have gone on the record for sometimes the first time, or they had very little chance to talk about what happened before. And it paints a clear picture of there was stuff up in the sky moving around, flying around, and beaming lights down. And the thing is that planets and stars don't do that. The lighthouse was going around in a circle. And I mean, it's ludicrous for him to say what he's saying, but okay, fine, you're saying it. You want to draw the attention yourself, then okay, let's show everybody. I hope that when we go out there that night, if he shows up, I hope there's 10,000 people out there. You know, I mean, and I know that sounds crazy, but come on, Ian, show us. Show us what you have taken and tried to twist and turn, and show us that's what it is. Show the people. I mean, show us and the people that's what it is. It wasn't. We know that. But he keeps jumping in and doing this, so it's his chance. It's his 5-second chance for fame.
Well, and you know, another thing that disproves that it was the lighthouse, a lighthouse doesn't shine a beam straight down out of the sky to the ground as this object did to the weapon storage bunkers.
Right. There has been people that have said that something beamed down inside the weapon storage area. Clearly they have said that. What I have said is when I was out there with Colonel Hall that night, there was beams of light coming down towards that area. I cannot confirm, you know, that they actually went inside the area, but I can confirm that there were beams of light coming down in the area of the storage area. You're right about that. That's what I mean. But for whatever reason, and I don't understand this, and that's like I said, I go back to the BBC, who I thought was credible. They don't want to let anybody else talk about it. They don't want to explore what he's had to say. And he's had a free pass. Anything he's ever said, he's just allowed to get away with it. And it's never been looked at. It's never been worked over and broken down like he's done to us and other people have done to us. So, I mean, we have just every little thing we say is put under a microscope. It's amazing sometimes.
This is true. A quick question from our virtual auditorium. This one's from Gossamer, and he asks, have there ever been any civilian witnesses that saw any of the objects that have come forward?
Okay, yes, there has been. There's been different pieces that have been done over the years. Sci-Fi did a piece, and I believe they identified some of the witnesses. I don't have the names in front of me. And I know that there's a magazine now in England that is going to be doing a piece on Bentwaters in December that has, I believe, somebody that's working the end of having some of the civilian witnesses that saw some of the things, same things that we did come forward. And I also believe there was a couple books written early on that had some of the witnesses in it, including, I believe, Georgina's book, Bruni's book, You Can't Tell the People, had mentioned some of the witnesses and what they saw.
That's cool. The only civilian that I knew of was a gentleman that lived in one of the farmhouses there on the borders of Rendlesham Forest.
Right. No, there's more than one. And like I said, I don't have that information in front of me right now, but there's clearly more than one witness in her book. I believe there was a book done by Dot Street, Jenny Randalls, and Brenda Butler, and they had other witnesses that were there that, you know, that they spoke to. I know the Sci-Fi had one or at least one, if not two, on there. I know, if I remember off the cuff, there was a couple that were driving home that saw something. There was a guy in the area where we lived that saw something. And you'll see that there was stuff that happened after our incidents even that Linda's reported on. And there's been other people that have come forward that said they've seen strange lights out there in the forest before and after also. So this is not something that, you know, is new or that only one or two people saw. There was a lot of people involved in this that heard and saw something.
Okay, there's a comment that's been posted a couple of times now in the virtual auditorium, and I think it needs to be addressed because I think there might be quite a few people out there that aren't familiar with the Rendlesham Forest incident and don't quite understand the full situation that happened on those evenings. The comment is, I don't see how anyone can doubt their word, like I said before. A bunch of drunken soldiers ought to know what they damn well saw. John, you and I can both tell them, no, you guys weren't drunk because you were on duty that night.
Well, right, we weren't drunk. I mean, how's the best way to put it? Because Jim and I have talked about this quite a bit in the past few months. From the very beginning when it happened, we didn't know what we were dealing with. I mean, we went out in the forest and observed something strange. We reported it to our superiors, which, by the way, if you take a look, if you look across the board from the time it happened all the way till now, there hasn't been a single one of them that's come out and said anything negative about us. They've never said that we're lying, that we what we're saying isn't true. And one of the things that Jim and I just discussed about that was very interesting, we wondered even why, was that where we were at, there we're on certain programs involving what we were involved working with, and we never even got relieved of duty to even, you know, to be talked to about it as far as brought in and said you're crazy or is anything wrong with you or whatever. We just continued to go back to work. And the Air Force has never come out, even with Roswell, they came out and tried to say it was dummies or a weather balloon. They have never come out and say anything negative about what's been said or what's been put out there. Matter of fact, the only thing they ever came out and said was, when CNN first started looking into this after the story broke in the early 80s, was that we stand by Colonel Hall's memo. So for us to be someone to say we were drunk or there's something wrong with us is perfectly ludicrous to me. I mean, we were doing our job. And we didn't ask to go out there as far as we didn't come on duty at night wanting to go out there and have what happened to it happen to us. But we did go out and do our job, and we did report what we saw. Now, I can't help it if people don't like that, and I can't help it if people don't agree with what we saw. But the point is what we're telling you is what happened.
Exactly. Another question from our virtual auditorium. This one's from New York, Lily, and she asks, if you would tell about any of the debriefing with the hypnosis and sodium pentothal, if you were involved on that part, sort of a debriefing.
Okay. As far as that goes, there have been people that have gone on the record and said that they were brought in and interrogated. Jim has been out there where it's been talked about where he was brought in. He's been openly talking about how he was debriefed and different things have happened to him, to including under his notes is that it came out that he was injected with the sodium pentothal. I have always said, and I stand by this, that as far as what I've said, that I don't ever remember being called in or worked over by OSI or debriefed or threatened as far as like some of the other people have said. Now, when I say that means that's what I don't recall. But that doesn't mean that what the other guys are saying is wrong or false. And that doesn't mean that if I was called in and they were able to do something to block my memory, couldn't have happened. And I'm not saying they did. I'm just saying the possibility is there they may have, because so many other people have remembered bits and pieces and stuff that's happened to them with what being called in like that. So for the record, I don't remember it, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen to me, and other people have commented that did happen.
Yeah, another question that's in our virtual auditorium is from Ian SP. He asks, I heard at least one of them walked up and touched it. Is this true?
God, I wish Jim could be on. Could have been on with us tonight. Yes, Jim was the closest to it when I was with him that night. And Jim has gone on the record and said that he did put his hand on it and activate it, some kind of code, and did touch it. Yes, he did.
The Laughlin conference. Was it this last February? I think, wasn't it, or the February before?
I'm sorry, the Laughlin conference, they did something this February, I believe. I was up at the Vegas conference last November with Linda.
Yes, okay. I was in attendance at that presentation, and I have to admit I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was about one of the most informative presentations on the Rendlesham Forest that I had ever heard. Even the Sci-Fi Channel, their two-hour program on it, I think, had less information than what was presented that night. And I have to admit that listening to the recording of Jim talking about walking around this object and describing its look and feel and dimensions and shape and all of this and all the strange light patterns coming up through the surface, so to speak, of this object, just had me spellbound. I mean, gosh, I probably would have been too chicken to go up to it and touch it for fear of radiation burns or something.
No, that's understandable. I mean, it truly is. But, I mean, like I said, I mean, this is straightforward. When we went out there, we didn't know what for sure was going on. And things happened quickly, and I mean, and we just reacted to them the best that we could. And I mean, that presentation that you saw has been a lot more has been added to it. And we've done several since then with new witnesses, and a lot of it can be viewed at Linda's site, Earth Files. And we just recently did a presentation with MUFON in December in the national in July at the national conference, with even more being added to include a lot of new stuff from Monroe Nevels, who was out there on the third night with Colonel Hall in the Geiger counter and taking the radiation readings out there.
I was reading that, too, and found that quite interesting. Kind of before we go all the way into Mr. Nevels' information, at the Laughlin conference, it came out that there was a possibility that you had been taken up into this craft.
Okay. So whether you want me to comment on the whole thing?
Well, yes, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, sure. This is something that's been going on way before the Laughlin Conference. Matter of fact, that was the first contact I ever had from Chuck DiCaro and Linda Moulton Howe. Chuck DiCaro being the guy that did the special assignments report for CNN back in the early 80s, which at the time it was interesting. It was the highest rated special assignment report ever done by them on the Rendlesham incident. And then Linda was that they had received information almost from the very beginning that somebody jumped up on it, took a ride on it, or something to that effect. And the name that came out was myself, my name. Now, I told Chuck at the time, you know, as far as that particular time with Chuck, I just told him something. I was involved in an incident, but I wasn't going to comment on anything because I was still on active duty and I was completely caught off guard by everything that came down the way it did. But Linda and I stayed in touch over the years. And then for her, after I had some contact with Monroe, and, you know, she went ahead and interviewed him. For him to come back out and say that he was told about that too, kind of explains where it first probably started from. Now, what I can say is that I got close to something twice, on the first night and on the third night. Now, I do not have any memory or recollection of being taken up into something, okay? And the fact that it's out there and it's come from many different sources is very interesting, and the fact that I can't remember is even more interesting, and if you go to some of these witnesses and talk to them, which I've been doing quite a bit over the last few months, there are things that people can't remember, and that is an interesting thing in itself, and a lot of people come out and say we're purposely doing that or nothing really happened to us then, but there's legitimate areas where people don't have the same story or what they remember happening, or don't remember what the other person remembers happening, and that is the truth. And that in itself says something, too, including also the fact that as Linda's worked on, and most people have not done a lot of work with, is there was radiation out there. At the very beginning, some people tried to make it sound like it was a huge amount, which it wasn't, but there was more than background radiation out there, to include the fact the MOD said there was, and the readings that Monroe took and verified. So what was out there in the forest in that area where we were that would leave that kind of radiation?
That's true. Reading that article on Neville, and he was talking about how he was using the Geiger counters to check the readings that he had to go to the lowest setting on the counter, and at that setting it pegged it. We have another question here from New York Lily, and she was wanting to know if it was true that the night that you and Peniston and Kabanzak were out, that you were out of radio, or you guys were out of radio contact for about 45 minutes.
Yes, this is the way it played out. Okay, we had problems with the radios. There was a point when we did not have contact with CSC, and about a year ago, Linda talked to the shift commander, who also said that for over, I believe it was 45 minutes, that they did not have radio contact with us. So there definitely was points when they didn't have radio contact with us, and the 45 minutes is sounds like a good reference point. It could have been a little bit more, it could have been a little bit less, but there was a point in time when they completely lost radio contact with us.
And there's several people asking about the LIDALs that were brought out, on whether they just shut down on their own, or did the object or objects shut them down?
Well, interestingly with that, I wasn't actually out there at the very beginning when they were bringing the light offs, but I have spoken to people that were there that were involved with the light offs and recently, and the light offs did not want to work. They weren't coming on. They even replaced some of them with new ones, made sure they had fuel, And even Colonel Hawks talked about that. He was out there when the light owls first were brought out. That for whatever reason, these light owls would not come on, and they would not work in the area where they set them up.
Interesting. Interesting. Getting back to Monroe Neville, his job was disaster preparedness response team. And he says that Lieutenant Bruce England had told him that the tower there in London had had an object on the radar and had called Woodbridge asking if they had it too. Is that correct?
Okay. Now, what Monroe was told and what I know that I was involved with on the first night was this. After what we saw, when we saw what we saw in the forest and we reported it and we were working on going out there, Peniston was on the phone with CSC. And what did come up was the fact that, Eastern Radar did have contact with something over our area and it disappeared. Now, I'm not sure if Eastern Radar contacted us or if we contacted Eastern Radar, but the fact was that there was verification that something was over the area on radar and disappeared. And for the skeptics and everybody else, one of the reasons why, and if you go and look at Earth Files and you look at Lieutenant Buran's statement, was the reason why we were sent out there was because of the fact that there was stuff lost by radar over our area, and what we saw and some of the colors that we saw, there was a possibility that something did crash out there that could have been an aircraft. And that was one of the biggest reasons why initially we were sent out there in the woods. We weren't sent out there to go look for aliens or UFOs or whatever. There was possible evidence between the radar and what we were seeing of a craft, or not craft, I think so bad, which was worse, of an aircraft that could have crashed into the woods. And we were sent out into the woods to see if that's what had happened.
Okay, that clarifies that up quite a bit. We have another question here from our auditorium. This is from TRMT, and she asks, am I correct that Colonel Halt is being much more open about the incident now? Colonel Halt's tape recordings were very important, as well as Sergeant Peniston's drawings and journal-type records.
You know, that's something that needs to be expanded on, not just about Colonel Halt, but all of us. One of the things that I find interesting is Ian and other skeptics like to say, well, they never said this, or they never talked about this, or they never did this, and why are they doing it now? Well, from the very beginning, from the time this happened all the way up till now, we, all of us, have done our best to talk about what we've been asked. If you notice, other than Halt did come out last year and do a press release saying he felt what was out there could be ET in nature, we are the ones that are being contacted and asked the questions. We're not the ones out there blogging about it every day, talking about it every day and everything else. So when we are asked a question, when something's brought to our attention, we'll talk about it. And one of the things that was going on was last year, there was a guy in England that wants to do a movie. He's trying to put together a movie. And I have my differences with him, and I still do. He felt that Colonel Halt's story should be the one that's in it, no one else's. Okay? And I said, well, if you're going to talk about the whole incident, I believe Jim and I, or at least Jim or one of us, should be involved in talking about the first night. But the bottom line was he pushed Colonel Halt to go on a record about what he felt it could be. Now, if you look at what Colonel Halt said over the years in different interviews, he's hinted around that it's unexplainable what we saw, and he doesn't understand what it was. And he just went a step further this time and said he felt what he saw was ET in nature. Okay, so he's just, a lot of it, what's going on is we're responding to questions. And I don't want to make it sound like at the beginning they weren't intelligent questions, but so long after this incident happened, all we were doing is spending our time trying to justify what we said we saw. And so many people were out there just trying to ask questions and prove that something happened. And it seems like now, after all these years, it's pretty much established in most people's minds that something strange happened to us. and we're getting more deeper and in depth into what it was and what went on, and less about did it happen or you know, or did anything really ever really happen out there in the first place.
Okay. It's understandable. I mean, when people first approached you guys, you were just saying basic, the basics, the raw basics. But as time is going on, in other words, you're telling more and more detail, which I think is fantastic.
Right, but we're also getting more detailed questions. It seems like, I think we've gotten past the stage of most people just wanting to hear us describe we went out to the woods and saw something strange, and they're trying to put something behind what we said happened and ask more detailed questions. And that's a good thing. And I really find it funny that the people that want to be critical of us try to use that against us, that we said this, we said that, now we never said this before, or they want to take one little thing that we said and then take it and expand on it into some kind of a paragraph saying that backs up what they said.
Okay. Another question here from our virtual auditorium. This one's from Leinster, and he asks, were there any fighter jets in close proximity of the objects?
Okay. The three nights that happened, and the dates have been pretty much established now, and I said these dates in the beginning, but through documents that we've got recovered from the British police and other sources, was we came on duty the night of the 25th into the morning of the 26th, which in England would have been Christmas night, and they have a thing called Boxing Day on the 26th. Okay, that would have been Thursday night into Friday morning. Now, those two nights, the base was dead. There was no activity, no flight line activity, no planes, no helicopters, no not anything. The 67th was always on standby, and what I mean by that is they had somebody on duty at MOC, which is their radio control, for standby in case something strange happened, or even if an airplane went down, you know, somewhere out that was out flying from another base. But there was no plane or helicopter activity on our night into the first morning. The 26th into the 27th was some strange things happened. I was not out there that night or on duty. The third night, which I was out there with Colonel Hall, that at no time did I see any helicopters or airplanes in the area.
Okay. And one thing I meant to touch on a little bit at the question on the radio contact, you guys had to have, it was Kabanzag, if I remember correctly, be a bit of a distance away from you and Peniston to relay radio messages back and forth to the base, right?
Yeah, at one point Ed was behind us, and Jim and I were forward of Ed, yes.
About approximately how much of a distance between you two and the craft and Kabanzag?
You're talking about on the first, when we first came up on it?
Yes.
Okay, that's the difference that Jim and I have. Jim's memory is he feels that it was just Tim and I there. But if you look at Ed's gone on the record and did some interviews, including I Know What I Saw, which was done by James Fox, and I believe he did something with Sci-Fi. Ed was there next to us, and Jim and I have talked about this, and he doesn't remember Ed being there, but it was Jim and I and Ed when we first came up on it at the very beginning. And that's one of the things when I went into earlier about there are some differences in what we remember and, you know, and how we encountered it.
Okay.
And if you look at the statements, there's one by Jim, which he has said openly that he didn't do that statement. He said there's a certain way he did the statement, and that isn't the way he did it. But my statement that's out there that's been done with the drawing is the statement that I made. And I'm not sure if Ed stands by his statement that was put out there or not, but it clearly shows Ed and I say that we were together when we first encountered whatever it was.
Ah, okay. I bet that's an aspect that I was totally unaware of.
But no, that is a fact. Is I clearly remember Ed being there with us, and the three of us when we came up on whatever it was, you know, whatever it was we encountered, we were all three together. Now, after it moved up and moved back, then eventually we did split up, yes.
Okay, that clarifies that up quite a bit, you know, because all these years I've been going under the assumption that that's, you know, what had happened was to relay radio transmissions. Excuse me. If you could make a statement to any skeptic, you know, it doesn't have to be one in particular, what would you say to them? If you could say it to them face to face, what would you say to them?
It's pretty easy. First of all of us didn't ask to have happen what happened to us. And we've been as honest as we can, at least I have, and I believe others have, on what we saw and what happened to us. And most of the skeptics, if you listen to what they have to say, don't believe in anything other than what's on this earth. And I accept that. And to be honest with you, and Jim, I believe he said this yesterday, was I did not doubt that there could be something from somewhere else, and that, you know, we could be the invisited, but it wasn't something that was on my mind or I was worried about having happen to me. But in saying that, it did. And I just would like to look at them straight in the face and say, what if this happens to you? What if something strange happens to you? Let's don't even draw a line of it was aliens or little green men or anything else. But let's just say you were somewhere where you were involved in something that you can't explain happened to you. And through no fault of your own, and nothing that you did or said tried to bring it out, you just kept quiet about it, but then it was brought out that you were there and you were involved in this. And then you were asked to comment on it, and you openly stated what you saw and what you felt happened to you, and then have people like them come back and attack every single word that we say. They come out and come after us on every little thing. We could make a five-page statement, and they would take one sentence out of it and try to attack us on it and not say another thing about anything else we've said. And I would like to know how they would feel if it was reversed. I would like to have them think for a minute and have them go through the same scenario we did and be honest to themselves and ask them if they would want to be treated the way they treated us.
Bravo. A lot of those guys can be very, very obnoxious and very, very rude.
Oh, no doubt. And then they tried to claim that we're looking for fame and money, and yet if they just came out one time and said they don't believe in what we said and they stand by this reason, then maybe they would have a leg to stand on, and is the fact that they're not doing, you know, going out and trying to look for fame or whatever piece they're trying to work on. But they want to say that that's what we're doing when people are coming and contacting us, but then they're out there writing their books, promoting their websites, and going out and talking on TV and attacking us left and right, and then saying it's okay. And they're justifying it, well, they just don't agree with what we have to say, and that they're really not looking for any, you know, credit or fame to all this. When actually what they're trying to do is they're doing a disservice more than we are. We're just being asked for what we saw, and we're trying to explain it. They're the ones out there attacking us, but they don't look at it that way.
Oh, exactly. In fact, a comment from our virtual auditorium from New York, really, in reference to this BBC article, her statement was, "The author is an economist. Why the heck is he writing about UFOs that he doesn't believe in anyway?"
Well, that is a good question, and I can't tell you how many people so far have contacted the BBC, but my hope is that what she just said, people will echo and then throw their own two cents worth in and ask the BBC why. Why, after all these years, did they decide, and I guess, and I don't know that much about England other than I know the BBC, when I was there and over through the years, was supposed to be a pretty credible source of news, and they pride themselves on this, and I've understood the BBC4 is a pretty good station. Why would they come out and do it the way they did and allow this guy to do what he did?
I agree. I mean, we have another question from our virtual auditorium. This one's from TRMT, and she asks, I thought I remembered John mentioning during the presentation at Denver this month that he and several of the servicemen experienced problems sleeping after the incident.
Is that all the question?
Yes.
Yes. To go into my point, and then I can talk a little bit about Jim and I believe a couple other people that have said some things. I definitely have had trouble sleeping. I have some terrible nightmares. As far as nightmares is the word for it. I just have dreams and restless nights. I wake up covered in sweat. It looks like the bed itself, like you can tell, it's like all wrestled and everything. And by no means am I don't go down the next line and say somebody came and visited me. But the fact is that I've had some terrific trouble with sleeping and everything else. And I know Jim has talked about how he is on medication for dreams. They actually have him on medication through the VA because the dreams are so bad. And I just recently met with Monroe Neville, and he's had some of the same problems. So, yes, a lot of us have had troubles with dreams and everything else, yes.
In some of my research, I have found that it's not uncommon for people who've had a sighting or some kind of a UFO encounter, what have you, to have difficulties with sleep problems.
No, there's no doubt. And Linda and I have worked. I did hypnosis back in the 80s, late 80s, and Linda and I continued to try to work on hypnosis and to see what was there. And what we found since 1988, that a lot of what it came out in 88, it, for whatever reason, won't come back out again as far as it appears to be blocked. They can't even get through any part to get back to get me to talk about how incidents went on, you know, what took place. Where in 1988, I was talking about the incident, who I was meeting, and everything else. And at the MUFON, she played about a 7-minute clip of my hypnosis that was done in 88. And most people have said that, and you could tell in the room, it was just completely quiet. Everybody was just sitting and listening to it. And I mean, the fact that Jim and I both have gone under hypnosis separately, and this happened when we weren't talking, and we did know each other were going under hypnosis, and some of the same things came out about what went on, was also very interesting. And the fact that him and I both are having trouble with our dreams and sleeping, and so are others, is another thing that's very interesting.
Sounds to me like just a few months shy of 30 years, a lot of you guys have gone through, well, hell. I mean, has it really affected your not only your public life, but your personal life as well?
Well, I mean, here's the best way to sum it up. I mean, and I keep going back to this, but we went on after it happened. We went back to work, we went on with our lives, and then behind the scenes, which we didn't even know about, there was somebody working hard on getting this exposed. And I've said recently that I'm not sure if I agree with them doing it or not, not so much for the fact that I don't want to sound like the people of America, the USA and Britain didn't deserve to hear about what happened, but just the personal toll it's taken on us. And what I mean by that is that whether people like to admit it or not, our names have been put out all over the place. And clearly, in Colonel Halt's and Jim and mine and others, we weren't the ones out there jumping up and down trying to have that happen. And then once it did come out, people have come after us for years. And I mean, to sit there and be called a liar or a manipulator or what you're saying isn't true, or that there's no way that what you said happened could have happened, and you're mistaken, or you were fooled by planets or the White House or everything else, it is really hard. And then you've got to add in some of the physical problems that some of us have had, And yeah, it's taken a toll. And, you know, I don't know, you know, I say it's not fair to me, and there's other people out there that have had worse things happen to them, you know, not just being involved in an incident with the military, but in life. But I'm not happy with what happened to me, and by no means am I trying to say that what happened to me is more unfair than other people, but it still did happen, and I'm not happy with it. And I'm very unhappy with the command chain above us and the military itself and how they dealt with us and what they've done for us.
Well, then, you know, another argument against this being a hoax, you know, to throw at the debunkers. Why on earth would Charles Halt, who at the time was the deputy base commander, in other words, the second in command of the entire base, risk his reputation, his position, and his job, his rank, his credibility, everything, for a hoax?
Well, I mean, he didn't. And if you follow the story of the memo, after the incident, he was instructed to write a memo and turn it over to the British base commander on the base so they were briefed on what happened. And he did. And after that, he wasn't out there talking about it. It was the fact that FOIA, Freedom of Information, they were able to get the memo released, and then somebody else took the tape that he had and put that out for the public to hear is what started all this. And he, and I'm not sure for him, but in my case, after this all broke, I actually got orders and shipped out shortly after CNN started snooping around. But I was instructed by the military to acknowledge the fact that I was there and that I was involved in something, because they didn't want it to appear like they weren't allowing us to talk. But they wanted me to be very careful in what I said, as far as they didn't want me in uniform, and they didn't want me out there talking about some of the things that were being said, which honestly at the time I had no idea what was going on. And so therefore he did not want this to come out. He has said that. But in the fact that it did, and the fact that people have taken shots at him, Jim and I and others, the fact that it's been broadcast all over the place, then they also want to say it's not fair that he is out there talking about it and trying to explain what it is and what happened and clear up some of this stuff. So it's like there's people out there that all they want to do is attack you for whatever you do. And those are the people that need to be stopped. And people need to do what they're doing. Contact the BBC. If they're going to do a story like they've done, then put both sides out there and give people a chance to hear both sides, not just one.
Exactly. We have about 4 minutes till we have our top of the hour break, see if we can squeeze this question in. This is from Gossamer, and he asks, I know Nick Pope has often stressed the importance of the Rendlesham incident. Has John had the chance to talk with Nick about the case and what the MOD has on file about the case?
This spring, I did a conference with Lyndon Eureka Springs, and Nick was one of the speakers. And, yes, we did. We rode back from the airport all the way to Eureka Springs, there and back. We talked quite a bit while we were there at Eureka Springs. One of the things that Nick just recently did was we were doing a show, believe it or not, on Father's Day, that there was a forum being done with a group of individuals involved and some of the investigators that were involved, and he apologized to Jim Peniston and myself on the record, saying the way we were treated by the MOD. And right now, hopefully, he's going to help be involved with Jim and I coming over with getting a couple of speaking engagements for us and being involved in that whole part of it, talking about the MOD and everything else.
Oh, very good. Gosh, I wish I could afford to go to you know, if nothing else, just to be there to see if the skeptics show up, the BBC people show up. And
one of the interesting things is, and I know we're running out of time, is that one of the things they did this in May was Steve Bassett did a conference at the National Press Club, and believe it or not, you can now live streamline stuff. So it would be interesting to think if we could put something together where people could come on and where we could do a press conference and do some of this stuff out there with them, where everybody could actually maybe drop in and see it, even if they had to pay a small fee to do it.
that would be interesting. I would love to be able to watch that. If that comes off, you know, be sure and let us know, and we'll get the word out there so people can, you know, if they can't attend physically, they can attend virtually.
Right, and like I said, I've been in contact with Nick, and he's interested. Philip Mantle is interested, and we're going to do our best to put it together. And one of the things is Jim and I definitely are going to go over there, you know, as long as we're healthy enough to do it. We're going to be over there the 28th through at least the 31st of December, so.
Oh, awesome. And on that note, I think we can go ahead and go to our break. So we'll be back here with John Burroughs in about 8-9 minutes here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Sound interesting? Then join us here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Friday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Central for The Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner.
The Church of Natus with hosts Jeffrey Pritchett and Guy Weddle. 10 p.m. Central Saturdays. Opening the gates of the underworld and calling down beings of ancient starlight. Tune in and watch for the apocalypse on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come to our forum at mavisincarnate.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, Dee Andrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 Mormons. I'm your host, Dee Andrew. Tonight we've been talking with Mr. John Burroughs. John, as we get back into talking about this, horrible BBC article. There was a few things in here that I think would be interesting to hear your rebuttal on. One of these is kind of you know, kind of silly and funny to me that he would even state this in this article, where he says, But am I interested in UFO sightings? You bet. I love them in the films and documentaries you find on the channels in the lower reaches of your television's electronic programming guide. Until this week, that was the only place I had heard of the Rendlesham Forest incident of 26 December 1980. You know, is it just me, or does it sound like he's comparing this to an old sci-fi movie?
I guess, yeah, you could look at it from that way. The interesting thing is would be for him to come on and go on the hot seat like we have and explain why he decided to do this piece and why he picked out Ian Redpath, why the BBC in the first place wanted done and allow, like people said, he has no background in doing anything like this, why and why they came out after us. I mean, you could say, well, this is the 30-year anniversary and people are showing a lot of interest in it and all they're trying to do is kill it, which, you know, they may have thought this is what was going to happen with it, but it doesn't appear to be. It looks like it's got more people interested and fired up on it than it ever has, and they may have done us a favor in that case. But, yeah, he's definitely taking a shot at us, but, you know, it wasn't even, is that the best he's got? It's not very good.
Oh, well, that goes along with this next statement. He says, well, I'm not reading the whole thing, of course, I'm just picking out the few stuff here and there that I think is rather kind of insulting. He says, they saw a light fall from the sky and thinking a plane might have crashed, ventured into the woods. There they saw a flashing light in the trees and lights in the sky, vintage UFO stuff. But should we believe that there is any mystery to the episode?
Well, that's interesting. It's clearly he's trying to, you know, he's trying to make us look bad and he's taking shots at us. But that is not what Jim's talked about, what I've talked about, what Ed's talked about. And we clearly saw something come down into the forest and we clearly went out. But it's very clear that either he is chosen not to look at the incident at all and just make fun of it, or what he has looked at has scared him to the point where he's afraid to give us a fair chance, because he clearly didn't even try to talk about what we said we saw and what happened.
He was going on to talk about the Orford Ness Lighthouse and how this Mr. Redpath had said he was certain that was the reason or the origin, so to speak, of this whole thing.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, what I found is interesting, and I'm going to say this because I've had emails from Ian Redpath, from Dave Clark, who's been involved in this, and Ian has gone as far as saying I'm a credible witness, okay, and I believe in what I saw. And yet, they want to attack Colonel Holt. And something that Jim said yesterday, which I wasn't aware of myself, but the fact is, number one, there's a tape. And the tape is out there, and it's real time. And anyone that hasn't listened to that tape, or just heard some of the tapes that are out there that aren't very clear, try to get a hold of the clearest tape that's out there. I just got a hold of one that's actually been copied on a DVD right off the tape that Colonel Holt made. And if you listen to his voice and the guys involved out there, they're clearly shook up by something. And according to Jim, Colonel Holt was a combat controller in Vietnam, and his job was to direct aircraft in and out to sites and use binoculars and do all that kind of stuff. Now, I'm saying this from what I was told by Jim yesterday, and they're trying to sit there and say that a guy that went all the way up through the Air Force was a lieutenant colonel, and I want to clear up something you said was second in command of the base. Actually, the main person that's in charge of a base and a wing that size is actually the wing commander, which would have been Gordon Williams. Second in command would be the vice wing commander. The base and deputy base commander are like mayors of a large city. They fall below the wing, but they are important. I'm not trying to downplay that. But the main people, the big shots that were in charge were the wing and the vice wing commander. But he was out there, had been involved in this kind of stuff, and had something come over the top of him and beam a light down at his feet. And he's describing this as happened. And that's where I told Ian flat out, you've lost me. You know, you're going to sit there and try to explain that away with that he was looking at a star and he was fooled by it. And that's what this guy with the BBC is trying to do. And it would have been okay if he would have said, I've talked to Colonel Hall or one of the other people involved. This is what they have to say. And after hearing what they have to say, I don't believe it for this reason. But he just went out there on his own, which I'm interested to find out why he would take the time to go out and go in the forest like this with Ian Ripoff, okay, and do this and not let a single person who was out there, and Ian wasn't out there when it happened at night, okay, and have a chance to respond. To me, I call that pathetic because he's scared. He's scared to let us come out and talk about it, and I don't understand why. I don't understand why. And I don't understand why the BBC would take the time to let him do this and try to make it look like a joke like they did.
I have to agree with you, especially on the Halt's tape recording. I've heard it many times. And if you listen to it, you can hear the excitement, the adrenaline pumping in his system, so to speak. You can hear it in his voice. You can hear, you know, just about every range of emotion going through him. No surprise.
Right. And
fear,
at one point,
amazement.
You can tell, you can hear him saying, "This is unreal." And you can hear, and I'm sure, I mean, he doesn't probably want me to say this, but you can hear fear in his voice. And
exactly.
I would, my question, first of all, would be, to Ian, and I'm sure he'll come up with a smug remark like he always does because that's the way he is, but why would a guy be out there and do that so that he could be ripped apart like he did? What would he gain from it? What would the Air Force gain from it? What would anybody gain from it? Okay? And again, Chuck Holt wasn't the one that released his tape. It was released by somebody else. And then Ian loves to come back and say other people have made fun of what went on. Well, those are the same people that won't go on the record and say anything, won't do an interview, and they weren't out there. So I find it funny the people that weren't out there wanted a cheap shot us so bad.
Well, and another thing that I think is shows the stress factor of what, Peniston was going through when the three of you were out there, looking at his notebook. His handwriting is, it starts off calm, cool, collected, and readable. And the further into it it gets, the shakier his handwriting gets. And the further in you get, it gets almost unreadable.
Right.
He's shaking so bad.
Right.
You know, something like that, yeah, it could be faked, but I don't think to... I mean, seeing the beginning handwriting and the end handwriting, I don't think so. I don't think
right.
He was faking it.
No, I know. That's true. I mean, it's very true. And I mean, every little thing that's out there, they want to attack it. But the fact is that there's so many people that have gone on the record now that have said that they were on duty, that they heard the radio traffic, they saw things in the sky. There's a guy that came out that Linda's had out there. He was in the WSA tower on Halt's night, and he went into a description of how he saw an object hovering over the forest for quite a while, and blew a white light. And I'm just trying to remember exactly how he put it. So if I'm not exactly right, sorry, but there was light coming off of the main object shooting down into the forest. And you know, it's so clear that we had something strange happen to us. And what I find, like I said, I keep going back to this, is the fact that some people just can't deal with the fact that we were out there and we had a crazy or strange encounter.
Oh, and then a comment that New York Early posted in our virtual auditorium was something that we touched on briefly during the break. She says, and then there was the most ridiculous explanation. The cart of burning manure. That one really stunk. Pun intended.
Yeah, that came out last year, and I can't give you exactly which papers covered it in England, but it did come out, and they have some kind of wire service, I believe, just like we do the AP or UPI or whatever, and it was written, and it was ran, and it was in different newspapers, and what happened was that some guy from Ipswich came forward and said that he drove a truck out there with manure and it lit it on fire, and that was all the crazy colors that we saw. And there was an uproar by some people, and the guy that wrote the article was contacted, including me, and he came back and said he was sorry that he was just told by his editor that this guy came forward and to put the story out, and then he never even verified it, and he just ran the story as it was. And you know, I don't want to say they didn't retract it for sure, but I don't believe they did, and I don't believe they ever said anything much about, you know, how the story was misleading or anything else. And that's another thing, that people are giving a fair shot at us and try to tear apart what we say, but somebody can come out and make a crazy claim like that, or another guy, his name is Kevin Condi, that came out and tried to say he was out there playing a practical joke on us, driving around in a police car with his police lights on, his light flashing. And I say this because like, it's happened a few years ago, but I don't even believe he was on duty the night of the incident itself. And right away, Ian and all his buddies jumped on this and said, well, the case is solved. There's been so many times where they've come out and said the case is solved by something like what Kevin Condi said, by, you know, the guy with the manure and everything else. And even after it's proven completely wrong, it's still allowed to be out there. And, you know, and they think that's fair. They think that that's truly fair, and they don't have any reason to come back out and say they were wrong or apologize or anything else. And I mean, I almost guarantee you that this guy that wrote this article would not apologize to us for what he said. And if it was reversed on him, I don't think he would like the way we've been treated, and he wouldn't like to, I mean, in other words, he wouldn't like to be treated the way he's treated us and the disrespect he's showed us.
I agree. And for the journalist that wrote up the story of the manure truck and not, you know, checking the sources, that's just bad investigative journalism.
No, it really is. And it's stuff that went on in the early, you know, 80s and 70s where, you know, I remember I was pretty young, but they used to have guys out there dancing around in little suits and everything else and poking fun at everybody. But, you know, a lot has changed since then. And, I mean, I guess my question you asked me earlier about what I'd like to say to the news reporters and skeptics, would they want to be treated this way? I think that's a fair and honest question. Would they want to be treated this way, to have people come out and say things about them like they've said about us and taken reports and just ran with it and not verified it? Would they want to be treated the same way? And I would really like to hear their answer to it. You know, I would find it very strange if they said they would, and if they think that we've been treated fairly. That would be my other question. Have you treated us fairly? And I'm not talking about every person that's ever done an article on this or done a radio show or anything else. So please don't anybody try to spin it that way. There's been a lot of people, including yourself, that have given us an opportunity to come on now, talk about it and everything else. And I don't have a problem with that. The people I have the problem with are the ones that won't come to us before they run a piece or do a show or something and want to sit there and pick fun at us and make fun of us and make us try to make us look bad.
Well, you know, I agree with that wholeheartedly. You treat people the way you yourself want to be treated, you know, and the old saying, what goes around comes around. You know, I mean, gosh, Evan Davis is really doing journalism a disservice, I mean, big time.
Well, there's no doubt about that, and I agree with that. But one of the things I made a comment, I believe it was yesterday, on, you know, in some ways, you know, they're allowed to get away with it. I mean, and I'm not trying to pick on all the people that have come out in the support or are listening now or will listen or look into this later. But if you look at the media, a lot of times, just for an example, I use this, the guy that jumped out of an airplane at the beginning of the week, got mad and jumped out of an airplane, went down a chute that definitely endangered people. It's clearly that he did that. Took two beers, took off, stormed off, and went on his way. He got a ton of coverage. And the coverage at the very beginning was all positive, and now it's, as they've looked in deeper, it may not be what he said it was. And somebody created a Facebook site that got 200,000 people to follow this. Yet, here we've got an incident that happened, and it's clearly that it did happen, and there's a memo out there. We've got a tape with it happening. And like Lord Hill Norton said, that was the Lord of the Fleets in England, that it was clearly had to be of defense significance. And yet, and I'm not cutting down every person that's joined or listened or anything else, but the people who haven't, we've got 2,500 people that have shown interest in this case. Yet, for a guy that clearly lost his mind, there's 200,000 people out there that want to jump in on it.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, and I'm just saying that. I'm not sure 100% that's that many people, but I know I saw on TV, I'm pretty sure I saw on TV the other night, they said that he had over 200,000 hits on the Facebook site involving something that he did. Yet something that happened that's unexplainable, you know, and clearly happened, and it has significance to what goes on in the world and everything else, is just torn apart like it is by a guy like this guy on the BBC and made fun of.
You know, and you mentioned Lord Hill Morton in his statement. Another part of that statement that I thought personally was very significant was, and I'm going to have to paraphrase because I don't remember exactly word for word, but he said that if something truly breached our British airspace and landed on British soil, that is of national defense significance. But on the other hand, if these men were hallucinating or imagining or whatever that this incident happened, you know, that they're here helping to defend our country and whatnot, that too is of defense significance. So either way, which I'm not saying that you know what happened, you know, was a hallucination, because I don't believe it was, but you have to agree with that statement that either way, that's defense significant.
Well, no doubt. And if you look further, he went after Parliament hard on this, and he sent quite a few inquiries in and wouldn't let it go. So, you know, I don't want to go back to and say that he definitely felt that, you know, one way or another, for sure what happened, but it sure got his attention, and he sure was in the middle of it, and he sure didn't like the way it was handled, and he surely did some work with Georgina Bruni and her book, and I know he was supportive in her book, and the thing is that he wasn't fooled by what they were trying to do and say.
I've got some questions starting to pile up here. There's one I want to take real quick before the others, because I think it will kind of clear up some misunderstandings. This is from Andromedan, and he asks, why did they leave their posts and go wandering off into the woods? I know the answer to that, but I'll let you answer it, since you were one of the ones that experienced this.
Well, we didn't leave our posts, okay? We were, first of all, the first two of us were on a mobile patrol, and so was Jim and his rider, okay? It's clear, and it's been backed up by Lieutenant Baran's statement, that we observed something strange. There was contact on radar, and whether or not they contacted us or we contacted them, it was clearly that there was something there on radar. We clearly got in contact with the people above us. A decision was made to send us out into the woods to find out what was going on outside the base. So at no time did we just leave our post and wander off into the forest, unauthorized or with no purpose to go out there, other than, as you know, as the skeptics have tried to say, that we went out there looking for aliens. No, we went out there because something strange was going on, and we were sent out there to find out what it was.
In other words, you were following a lawful order to go out and investigate.
Yes, we were given an order, and it's clearly in Lieutenant Brand's statement that we were given an order, and it was his order to go out into the woods to investigate what was going on.
Okay, our next question comes from Gossamer, and he asks, did you ever hear any rumors or stories of MOD people trying to question or harass any of the U.S. servicemen after the incident?
I mean, yes, and what I mean by yes is there's books written out there that where people have made statements to that effect. I believe, and I'm going to say this, you know, as much as that is from memory serves me, was that even the forester that was out there, the guy that came on the record and tried to sell the Lighthouse Theory 2, he even said there were people out there from the MOD taking a look around and asking questions. So yes, I've heard and read that there were people out there from the MOD, not only out in the forest, but actually going around to different people's houses and talking to them, and yes.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting. I was totally unaware of that. Getting back to this BBC thing. gosh, I gotta find it again here. Here it is. They had just talked about the lighthouse and possibly seeing a satellite going overhead while they were out there in the woods doing their so-called investigation. And Ridpath makes the comment to him saying, "It's too good a story to allow to die. It's a combination of events which, when put together, sound inexplicable. But when you look at them individually, the bright light flashing away across the field was the Orford Nest Lighthouse. The bright lights that hovered in the sky for several hours were in fact stars. His mystery explained. It was an easy mistake for young Americans a long way from home to make."
Okay.
That is so condescending.
Sure it is, and he's got my response. I'm on the record saying, "Ian, let's go out in the forest and let's take a look together, okay?" It's real easy to take a guy out there that doesn't believe in anything, you know, other than what he says he believes in. But how about us taking the people that were there and taking them out in the forest and trying to sell that? And that's my response. Go ahead, Ian, say whatever you got to say. I'm on the record saying I'll be out there on the 28th of December, will you?
Another question from me concerning the lighthouse. Hasn't it since been proven that there is a board or a metal panel or whatever on the landward side of the lighthouse to prevent the light from going across the landscape, so to speak?
You know, I've seen different people talk about that, different things about how the way Ian's tried to spin it is impossible. And you know, it very well could be true. But, you know, what I have said, and I'll say it again, I've never been out in the forest, you know, as far as looking back at how it happened to us since I was out there the three nights I was involved. And I'm going back out there. And from what I've been told, and I haven't been back, but the forest is pretty much close to what it was like when we were out there 30 years ago, because they had a massive storm hit it shortly a few years after our incident and took it down pretty bad. But from what I understand, the forest is close to what it was like before, and I've also been told that the lighthouse is going to be deactivated in the next year or two. So, like I said, I'm willing to go out in the forest and stand there right where, you know, go as close as I can to where what happened has happened, and I'm willing to stand there and take a look and see if the lighthouse is actually coming through and will give the effect that we said we saw. I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to go out there and do it, okay? And I'm also willing to go out there and have them show me how the planets and the stars supposedly fooled me, you know? And I'm really waiting to see a star beam of light down at my feet. That's what I'm really going to wait for.
Okay. Have you been able to get this challenge, I guess you could call it, to him? Have you been able to get a written proposal to him?
Yeah, there's a forum that Ian's on, and as a matter of fact, he made some statements yesterday on, and even this morning over there. And I put the challenge out to him. I said, "Ian, let's settle this man to man. Let's go out there. Jim and I talked about this. Jim's going to be out there with me. We're willing to meet you out there that night and go ahead and have this happen." Now, he may have responded back since, you know, last couple hours, but up until the time I came on your show, he had no response. And I know he was on looking at my my statement because you can see who comes in and out. And he was clearly on there looking at what I had to say with no response. And not only am I saying that to Ian, but I'm willing to go out there with the BBC too. And I'd love to have the guy that wrote the story that gave none of us an opportunity to talk about what happened to us come out there with us. I'd like to go out there with them and have them have, see if they got the guts to look at us face to face and try to sell this to us. And anyone who wants to come out there also.
Okay, so Ian Ridpath, I believe, is the full name.
Yes, Ian Ridpath is the full name.
Okay, Mr. Ridpath, the gauntlet has been dropped. The challenge is made. Put up or shut up.
Let's settle this. Let's settle it once and for all. I mean, he has by far been given the most opportunity to say what he's had to say and talk about the lighthouse, the stars, the planets. And he does it, like you said, very smugly and very arrogantly. And okay, let's go. You know, he's always had things to say about us behind our backs, you know, and everything else. So now is the time. And it needs to be done for another reason, because we'll all be there. It won't be him and I and Jim standing there alone. I want other people out there, because then he's not going to be able to come back later and say, well, this or that. It's going to be for everyone to see. I mean, it really is. And I'd like to see if the BBC's up to the challenge. I still want to believe that they're a credible news organization. I really do.
I agree with that. You know, I think it's deplorable that they let him put this kind of garbage, out there. But...
And I want to say one
thing.
I'd like to thank everybody that's responded on Facebook. Everybody that's been there, all 2,500 of you. Believe me, when I said the other day about 200,000, every one of you is important, and I appreciate everything you've said and done and told your friends about and got more people involved. And I really, really, I say this myself, and I'm sure everyone else involved in the incident appreciates everything you did, and by no means am I undermining or trying to underestimate the 2,500 is not enough. It is great. It is awesome, and I hope we can get it up to 10,000 or more, okay? Because the more people we can get to take a look at this incident and understand that the guys out there doing their job at night were treated unfairly, and what they're trying to sell isn't fair, and it's wrong, and blatantly, at some points, just outlies, the better we can. And this is also not only for us that we're involved in this, but for anybody else that's ever had anything that's happened to them that's unexplainable and has taken ridicule from the skeptics and anybody else. I mean, there's been a lot of guys in the military that had stuff happen to them that have taken a lot of abuse for what they've had happen to them. There's been a lot of people out there that weren't in the military that had the same thing, and they've had to live through the ridicule and embarrassment and everything else and the personal attacks on them. And this is not just for us, it's for everybody. And the more people that come to realize that we're not being treated fairly by our governments, and not just in this and in other things, and will stand up and ask for a change, the better it'll be.
Hey, we've got a couple more questions here waiting on us. This one's from Gossamer again. He asks, when you were stationed there while in the service, did you ever see the light from the lighthouse at any other time?
I was on the gate at night and right after the incident, and I never, let's put it this way, if I ever saw the lighthouse at all, it wasn't in the way that what we had saw happen to us. To sit there and say I never saw the beacon of the lighthouse ever, I can't remember whether I did or not, but what we saw that particular night was not the lighthouse. And one of the things I've always said was, Sergeant Stephens asked me, because I'd been there, that I'd ever seen anything like that before, and I said no, and I hadn't, and I never saw anything like that afterwards either. And I was still there for about another 6 months or 7 months after the incident.
And another question concerning the lighthouse. This is from Carl, and he asks, most beacons and lighthouses can be identified from the frequency of the flash and the color. So I'm from what I understand, he's asking, you know, was the frequency of the flash and the color anything like what, you know, the lights that we're seeing out in the woods?
No, no, not at all, no.
Okay, very good. And this one is basically, you know, just a comment, but it made me think of your encounter with Peniston. Andromedan was asking, how come there's never any ET footprints like Bigfoot? One thing that a lot of people don't realize is the object that you and Peniston and Kabanjag saw left traces on the ground.
There was some damage to the trees. There was some indentations in the ground, and actually there was some plaster Paris, from the actual indentations. It was kept of how deep it was. But all that they try to explain away. But the one thing they can't explain is the radiation. And what they've tried to do is say that, well, you know, people have said it was a high dose and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, it wasn't the night that they were out there at the Geiger counter. It wasn't a high dose. But the MOD has stated that it was above background. The guy that was actually out there running the Geiger counter has clearly gone on the record, and you can hear it on the tape of what readings he was taking, and it was clearly above background. And like I say, I like to poke fun at this, but the last time I checked, stars, the light after planets, don't leave radiation, you know, in the area where we were. And Nevels went as far as saying that it was around the ring of the trees at a certain level he got all the radiation off the trees, and including the indentations where they were. And Linda went on and got a guy that talked about it. He'd been doing this for over 40 years with radiation and readings. And his comment was, and the question wasn't loaded on do you think it was ET or not, but is there anything that you're aware of that the United States or any government has that would leave that type of radiation in the area, you know, in the way it was left? And his comment was no. There was nothing out there that he knew of that we had that could leave radiation like that.
I couldn't think of anything. Well, obviously a lighthouse can't do that.
Well, you're right, and neither can planets or stars. And like I said, stars and planets can't have a beam of light come down at their feet. He's trying to say the thing that you can be fooled by looking at the star, and it might actually look like it's moving, and that could cause an effect. But you can clearly hear Colonel Hall say it's a beam of light coming down at their feet. I mean, where they were, you know. I mean, it's ludicrous. But he's allowed to get away with this.
A question that was just posted in our virtual, well, not really a question, more of a statement. This is from Eternal Being. He says, nothing is mentioned about air traffic control radar or tower control staff witnesses. Actually, we did touch on that a bit earlier. But if you'd like to rebut that statement?
Sure. Well, there's been discrepancies brought out that, like, Colonel Hall asked, you know, on his night, he contacted the command post whether there's anything on radar. There's been statements made that the United States went down and confiscated radar tapes from one of the British bases. There was a guy that came out and said that he did see something on radar, and the tapes were taken. But all that is out there. But the one thing that is clear, when before we went out there, Eastern Radar had something over our base, and it disappeared. And that happened. And Lieutenant Baran has gone on the record and said he was in contact with Eastern Radar. So he's made it clear to say, and it was funny the way he put it, was he didn't want to say that, well, that it had to be some kind of unidentified, you know, alien ship or something like that. He just simply said that they had something on radar that disappeared over our base, and that's what we went out to look at, which is the truth. And of course there's going to be people that try to jump in and say, you know, it was obviously from somewhere else. But we don't know. But there was clearly radar contact, and there was clearly something on radar that disappeared, yes.
Oh, here is a very good question. This one is by Marcy, and he says, why wasn't the base placed on red alert?
Well, that's been brought up over the years, and it was off the base, okay? It was off the base. And I myself have had some questions from some of the command officers that I've had the opportunity to meet with behind the scenes. And the base itself, Woodbridge Base, was not under any direct attack. The question about what happened out inside or right outside the weapons storage area is something that I've even brought up, that I'm not really sure what was going on with the people that were running the show on that end of the thing and what decisions they made. But just because you have something outside a base that is not doing anything hostile at that moment, which it wasn't. I mean, in other words, nobody was zapped or taken, you know, away as far as, you know, lifted up in the sky and they couldn't account for or anything like that. There would be no reason for the base to go on full alert.
Agreed. Because basically, like you said, it was off base property.
Right.
Therefore, you guys really didn't have much of a authority, so to speak, to initiate something like that, because it was technically not your territory.
It wasn't only our territory, but we couldn't identify what it was. In other words, trust me on this part. If at any point in time we would have been come under attack, and what I mean by attack is that somebody would have been, and that'll go back to what people said, that I was lifted up into it or anything like that. What I'm trying to say is if anybody had disappeared, if, in other words, if somebody was there and was gone and they couldn't get accounted for whatsoever or anything like that, if something would have gone into the storage area itself and, you know, became a threat inside the storage area or whatever else, anything of a hostile nature, the base would have immediately went into certain security levels. But when I was out there and what I've been able to come up with over the years, there was no hostile action taken against the base or us. And what was going on behind the scenes and what the command post was doing, did they notify Mildenhall or 3rd Air Force? I can't answer that. I would assume, I know the wing commander was on the radio. I know the base commander was on the radio. I know they were monitoring everything. They had our lieutenant colonel out there that was the deputy base commander working on what was going on. Everything was being recorded through the command post, and I'm sure people were being briefed on what was going on. But at no time did they make a final decision to feel it was hostile in nature, is the best way I can describe it. So at that point, there would be no reason for an alert.
Several months ago, you were involved with a three-hour roundtable discussion with yourself, Larry Warren, Charles Halt, Peniston, and I forget who all else was on, but it was the first one you guys did. I was able to listen to that one. I keep meaning to listen to the second one because I'm hoping it was just as good as the first one. Is there any plans on doing another roundtable discussion like that?
Well, what happened was I wasn't involved with the first one. I was actually, and Nick was there too. We were in Eureka Springs, so we had a recorded, you know, interview done that I don't even think I played, but there was other people on. The second one was Father's Day, if I'm not mistaken, and it didn't go off very well because they had so many technical difficulties where things just weren't working right. The third one was canceled, and I believe there's something coming up at the end of this month, and Linda's going to be on, and it's going to be a two-hour segment, and I have been asked to come on at one point during the segment and talk about some of the things, and I believe Steve LaPlume is going to also come on. And I'm saying that as of now, that's what I've been told, but I don't think anything officially has come out yet. But yes, and she's going to be talking a lot about what she's worked on and the new witnesses and everything else that have come forward.
Oh, cool. I'm looking forward to that. Getting all you guys together like that to talk about it really helps to educate us that weren't there. You know, and I applaud you guys, you know, being brave and coming forward and doing that. Let's see, we've got about 4 minutes left. We have, could we sneak in this question real quick? This one's from Gossamer, and he asks, when things like the LIDALs were taken out there, is there any kind of paperwork that had to be filed to requisition the LIDALs for use and a reason given for why they were needed?
Well, I can't speak for the LIDALs, but there was incident reports done on this. They're called 1569s, and those are just like what they use in, you know, on the civilian side of police reports. And there was also blotter entries made on this. But interestingly enough, they all disappeared. CNN requested them, and the Air Force response was they couldn't find them. One of the other things that came out of it through the MOD release, and it came from the MOD files now, and people will try to say that it didn't happen, but General Gabriel, 3rd Air Force Commander, came down shortly after the incident happened, and they stated, collected all the information that involved with this incident to what Jim and I believe were including the recordings made to the Wing Command Post and took them back to the 3rd Air Force. And also the fact that I actually a few years later went down and took a look at the wing history down at Maxwell Air Force Base, and it was missing. And the fact that almost all the evidence disappeared that involved the case, to include shortly, I believe it was either at the end of January or early February, the Secretary of Air Force also came in into the base also unannounced.
Okay, we've got roughly 2.5 minutes. Is there a speaking engagement you've got coming up, or any activities? And also, we want to let everybody know that they need to go onto Facebook and check out the Justice for the Bentwater 81st Security Police at Rendleton Forest 1980 page.
Yes, please do that, and thank you to everyone that's joined and will join, and thank you for all your support, and please contact the BBC and let them know how happy you are with it if you are. Earth Files is another site to keep up on it, because we're continuing to interview more people, and we're putting the interviews out. Coast to Coast, Linda does a monthly report on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, and usually at least every other month she'll put something on about Bentwaters. And there's nothing coming up except for our trip to England at the end of December right now, but I'm sure there'll be other stuff next year that we'll be involved with. It just we haven't put it on the schedule yet, but definitely, folks, we will be in England, and we're going to do our best to get it out to as many people as we can, the 28th or the 31st of December.
Gosh, again, like I said, I wish I could be there to join in on that. That would be an awesome thing to witness.
Well, I hope, and I can't speak for where we would do it, but I would hope they would take a hard look if there was enough interest to streamline it. Especially, you know, I don't think they could streamline us going into the forest, but they could at least, we're willing to come on beforehand and do a conference, talk about it, and do a speaking engagement prior to going out to the forest. And then also we're willing to do it on, you know, on the days afterwards too, including in London. So hopefully that they could, you know, at least streamline it back would be really good. I think if enough people contacted somebody like Mantle or Nick Pope and there was interest in it, I'm sure they could find somebody to be willing to do it.
Well, if you guys do are able to pull that off, be sure and let us know so we can get the word out there.
Oh, we will. And I would be happy to come back on and talk about it again closer to it happening, and hopefully Jim would too. I would assume he would. I just couldn't get back a hold of him today. I'm sure he was up to doing something. Out here in Arizona, it's so hot right now you don't want to leave the house, but back in the Midwest it's actually cooled down a little bit from what I heard. So.
Oh, hey, I live in Arizona too, and yep, it gets so hot out here, the swimming pool water even gets hot.
You know, and it's really hot right now. This is one of the hottest weekends they've ever had in August, so no fun right now.
Well, unfortunately, we are all out of time. Thanks again, John, for joining us, especially at the last moment of this. I definitely appreciate it. This has been a great discussion. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and I've enjoyed it very much. The 2 hours were way too fast. Thanks again.
Oh, they always do. Well, that's all the time we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank all those who joined us in the Pow Talk Auditorium. It's been a great bunch tonight. I'd like to mention, too, that if you'd like to keep up with the Lofi Fortune West website, it's at www.fortuneswest.com. And stay tuned for Voice of the People, tonight hosted by guest host Brenda Greensdale, and tonight her guest is Robert Duvall. And please join us again next Saturday for Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.